Okay, we start a new book this week, and the book is called Shemot. Shemot means names. It's very, by the way, it's a very strange name for the book. And the English name for the book is called Exodus. Which is a better name, Shemot or Exodus? You know, without any question, Exodus is a better name. The way that the book is referred to in the Ramban's introduction, it's called Sefer HaGeula, the Book of Redemption. And that's something which I want you to think about. Because if the name of the book should be names, that reflects the second word, Ve'ela Shemot. These are the names of the children of Yaakov. Move up, move up. It's better that way. Better than me losing my voice. You should move up. So names is not the topic of the entire book. Now, if I say that the topic of the book is the Exodus, leaving Egypt, Exodus, leaving Egypt, that only takes me approximately towards the 15th chapter, which means I still have another 25 or so chapters to go, which seem to be disconnected to the book. On the other hand, the name that the Ramban tells us, Sefer HaGula, the Book of Redemption, that may be a much deeper idea. Because redemption is not merely a geographical reality. Redemption is something which is more than that. And in order to really try to illustrate this, I want to get to a verse which sometimes plays tricks in our minds, because we think we know what it is, but we could be making a mistake. So let me pick on the rabbinic students in the audience, and then I'll pick on the rest of you afterwards. First we'll humiliate them, and then we'll move over to everyone else. When, and you don't have to, if you want, I can answer the question myself. God approaches Moses. God approaches Moshe and says, Moshe, you're the man. You're the guy. Take my people out. You're going to go to Paro, tell him, let my people go. So what's Moshe's response?
Why me?
That's good. Is that what he says? Absolutely correct. So let's take a look. Moshe sees the burning bush. He hears a voice saying, take off your shoes. He hears the voice saying, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Moshe covers his face, he's afraid to see God. God then says, I'm in chapter 3, verse 7 now, Perikimo Pasuk Zayin. God says, I have surely seen the suffering of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries, and I know their pain. And then God says, "Va'arid lehitzilu miyad Mitzrayim, I will go down and take them out." By the way, anything yet about Moshe? On Passover, we also say something interesting. What do we say? We say God did it. Lo yadei shliach, right? God did it. God took us out. So it's interesting. God over here says, "I will go down and I will take them out, and I will take them to the wonderful land, the land with which flows with milk and honey, and so on." He goes, and I've heard their cries, he reiterates that, and I've seen the pressure which the Egyptians are pressuring them. And now, by the way, till this point, if you're Moshe, this is great. What's God doing? He's giving you some inside information. He's telling you what's going to happen. Telling you, go to Vegas, put your money down on the Jews leaving Egypt. God says, I got them out. V'ata lecha v'asha lechecha v'esh Lachacha. He goes, now I'm going to send you El Paro. I'm going to send you to Paro. V'hotzei et ami b'nei from Mitzrayim. And take my people out of Egypt. Now this is a little confusing because God just said that he's doing it, and now God is telling Moshe, you're going to do it. V'yoma Moshe Elokim, mi anochi ke'elech El Paro. Who am I to go to Egypt? V'chi yotzei b'nei from Mitzrayim. And will I take the Jews out of Egypt? Again, does he question God's ability? No. But he says, who am I to go to Paro? And by the way, this is one of the beautiful things about Moshe. Moshe feels inadequate. Moshe's inadequacy, if anything, just further enamors himself to us as a leader. Who would you rather? The leader said, yes, I've been born to lead. This is my right, and I'm going to do it. Or the guy who says, listen, who am I to do it? Moshe's modesty is at this point not disturbing at all. And then God says to him, I'll be with you. Vayomer ki eheyeh imach. I will be with you. And then God says, I'm going to give you an oath. What's an oath? I'll give you a sign. Right? So here's the question I wanted to get to. What is the sign that God gives Moshe? Because I'm going to give you a sign. I'm with you and I'll give you a sign. What's the sign? Don't cheat. Don't look into that. Leprosy. So leprosy comes to mind. What else comes to mind? The staff comes to mind. Good. So what does it really say? What? No, 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 no. Good. So you remember, but it's not what it says here. You remember what it says later on. I told you, people can't remember this. You know why? Because it's one of these things that never registers in your head. The problem that we have is not with memory. The problem is with filing. In order to file something, you first have to have noticed it. And if you don't notice it, you can't file it. But if you noticed it, then you can file it. And if you file it, then you can find it. So your problem is you can't find it because you never filed it because you never saw it. Right? And not only that, there's another reason. This part didn't make the movie. which is probably the primary issue in terms of us remembering this. And God says, I will give you a sign that I have sent you. I'll read the words exactly so that you won't give me a hard time afterwards. Vayomer ki eheyeh imach. I will be with you. Vizeh lecha ha'ot. We're in chapter 3, verse 12. And I will give you a sign, ki anochi shelachticha, that I have sent you. Botziacha et ha'am mitzrayim. When you take the people out of Egypt, ta'avdun et elokim al har hazeh. You will serve God on this mountain. Did you just miss something here? Right. God said, I'll give you a sign. And what's the sign? You'll serve me on the mountain. But where's the sign? It's like we missed something over here. And in your mind, when you heard sign, when you remember sign, you want something more impressive than that. You want to take your stick and turn it into a serpent. If it says serpent here, you'll have to look and see if it really says that. You want to take you want the leprosy thing. I mean, that's good. These are things which would impress any magician. But over here, when God says, I'm going to give you a sign and you're going to come and serve me on this mountain, the reason why we don't remember it is because we don't understand it. And the reason we don't understand it is because we don't see any signs over here. Where exactly is the sign? Do you all understand my question? Yes? Do you all remember why we got here? I was dealing with a larger issue. Any of you remember it or I completely lost you by now? What was the larger issue I asked? No, before that, the names. Good, we're back to the names again. Because if the name of the book is Shmos, it ends by the first verse. If the name of the book is the Exodus, that ends by the 15th chapter. But if somehow the book is related to standing in front of the mountain, guess what we just now did? We just now were able to be far more inclusive. We were able now to get all the way to Mount Sinai, which gets us at least to chapter 20. And maybe get to sort of the chapter 24, and maybe even, if we understand it correctly, it gets us all the way to the end of the book. Which means this verse, I don't want to like overstate my case over here, but in terms of the identity of the book, I'm not going to tell you this is the most important verse in the book, but in order to understand what this book is about, this may be the most important verse in the book. But we're not getting it yet, let's try to get this a little bit better and try to understand what's going on over here. And let's start all over again. Let's say the name of the book is the book of the Exodus or the book of redemption, the book of freedom. So what's freedom? And don't tell me freedom is just another word for having nothing left to lose, because that's not going to work.
According to this, freedom is the serve God.
So that's what we really need to get to. What is freedom? What does it really mean to be free? Because the book starts with the slavery. The book starts with with Jews being slaves. And it's not about being slaves, it's about being free. And what we really then need to understand, and by the way, this is not one of these quick, sound bites. it's really something which is very deep and profound to understand what is it, what is freedom. And maybe to understand what is freedom, we need to go the other way around and be able to understand what enslaves us. Right? What is it that really holds us back? What is it that stops us from accomplishing what we need to accomplish? What is it that doesn't allow us to be completely free? And then maybe what we're lacking over here is a real definition of what is freedom. So let's start all over again then. If this book is a book about freedom, so what is freedom? Okay, you want to go the other way around? What stops us from being free? Say that again. Subduing desire. That's very good. Freedom is about being able to control yourself. It's good because what you're identifying right now is something which is called gvura, strength. The Jewish concept of strength is radically different from the pagan concept of strength. And let's not make any mistake about it. Judaism comes and emerges to save a world from itself and save a world from paganism. In paganism, the concept of strength was wrapped up into the concept of being right. Right? You know, it's still true today, isn't it? Which side is right? The guy who wrote the history book, right? You wrote the history book, so now you're right. Now, what gives you the right to write the history book? You're still around. You defeated the other side. You get to write the story about what took place. Am I being correct? Am I being cynical? Maybe a little. But it's fascinating because your terminology was subduing the evil inclination. Right? Subduing oneself. Antiquity understood, in antiquity, man understood that what is strength? Strength is wrapped up with your ability to defeat someone else. Strength means to destroy somebody else. The more people I can destroy, the more people I can control, the more people I can subdue, the stronger I am. The more people I can subdue in more ways, the more validation I have. The more people I can control economically, the more people I can control militarily, the more people I can control politically, and the more people I can control sexually, creates my self or my sense of self and makes me into that much of a greater person. That is the pagan mindset. Any pagans? Are there any pagans still around in the world today? Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the pagan mindset. And it's more than that. It's by virtue of the fact that, here's where they went even further, by virtue of the fact that I can defeat them means that I'm morally correct to defeat them. My ability to defeat them makes me morally right to defeat them.
That's where I mean divine. That's where theology goes into play in paganism, because this makes me divine.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which means where the rest of the world is so much outer directed in terms of its sense of strength, right? Judaism produces a radical concept. And what is this concept? That what's real strength? Real strength is self-control. Don't think about strength in terms of being a little Napoleon and conquering Russia. Don't think about conquering the world. Think about conquering just one person. Conquer yourself. Conquer the animalistic tendencies within yourself, and then you show how you are a gibor, how you are strong. And therefore it says in the Mishnah, Ezehu gibor, who's considered to be strong? Hakov eshet yitzro, the individual who can practice self-control. From college.
College and from society in America in the past 30 years. So that's why I'm not understanding what you mean. But we can do it after class, if you would.
No, it's fine. Paganism had two different parts to it. Paganism had the rituals, right, in terms of what god it is that you serve, or gods, that you serve. So therefore, I can then simply say, the difference between monotheism and paganism is that monotheism is a little more economic. It's a good business decision. Instead of having to pay off a whole bunch of loans, right, you can, what's the word, consolidate. You consolidate and therefore pay off one loan. So therefore, if I use this as my definition in terms of paganism or polytheism versus monotheism, then I end up with a situation of serving one god, which is far more economic, consolidation, versus serving lots and lots of gods. That's not the whole issue. The issue goes far deeper than that, because if I understand that there's lots of different gods in the world, ultimately none of those gods are all-powerful. All of those gods are limited, which means every single god within the paganistic perception is going to be a limited god that can only help me in a very limited area. Being that all of those gods are limited, all of those gods would have needs because they're limited. None of them are transcendental and none of them are unlimited. None of them are infinite. Therefore, being that each one of these gods are limited and have needs, I could cut a deal with any of these gods, give it something, placate that particular god, and then create the situation I need. Now, what's fascinating about antiquity, before the time that Abraham comes into the world, before the time the Torah is given, is if I look at the ancient cultures and I say, okay, I understand what they wanted in terms of the paganistic ritual, but what was their worldview in terms of man and the fellow man? What did it tell me about the quality of life? What did it tell me about the holiness of life? What did it tell me about the way that one man should treat another man? And at that point, I find remarkable silence, which means, of course, you can counter and tell me, well, there's a Code of Hammurabi, for example. The Code of Hammurabi was not a work which emerged from a religious perspective. It was what Rousseau would have called a social contract, which means even within ancient societies, there was an understanding that we need some kind of social contract to avoid total anarchy. But what's fascinating is that none of the social contracts which emerged were at all related to the paganistic gods, who basically didn't care how people treated one another. All that they actually cared about was them getting a cut or being paid off within from the human beings. So that's part of what I'm referring to, because I think that you're right. When people start to look at paganism as per paganism, they're not necessarily getting to the theological basis or implications of what may come of it.
So paganistic views are right now concerning Egyptian, Roman, the Sumerian, and Babylonian gods, not Celtic, Western European.
Yeah, because who cared about Western Europe at that point?
Yeah,
okay.
That word paganism means that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so certainly within the.
Accounts of creation, for example, and they all share the same picture. Then comes the Bible with a complete, like,
that's different than what I was saying.
Okay, but as I said, this just, you know, in terms of getting definition.
Thank you, Francis. You answered exactly what I needed. What I didn't understand, how you used that term.
You were right. I understood from your question what you were looking for. Yecheskel Kaufman.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we get to that point which becomes fascinating. Abraham has this revelation. What's his revelation? That there's one God. What's the implication of there being one God? I realize I need to fill in a couple more space, more jumps now. What's the implication of there being one God? If there's one God, then by definition that one God has no needs, because that one God is infinite. If there's one God and it's infinite, it's not simply consolidating all of your loans. It's getting to a quantum leap. The quantum leap is between a bunch of gods that are limited versus one god which is unlimited. One unlimited god is fundamentally different from a bunch of limited gods, which means a bunch of limited gods, I can write a check and pay them off. One unlimited god, I can't do anything, which, by the way, is terribly frustrating to deal with a one unlimited god, because you can't do anything for that god. When a person, I'm not going to say can repeat what I just now said. I'm not even going to say when they internalize, when they really understand this point, it creates a revolution within one's religious perspective. Because people, including religious people, would like to believe that they can make God happy. They can make God's day. I do this little mitzvah, I do this little commandment, and God is up there high-fiving all the angels. I mean, that's what we'd like to believe. But by the way, I understand that exactly why we'd like to believe this, because we want to be significant. So in order for us to be significant, we would like to believe that we can impact God. But God, if God is infinite and unchanging, then how, in fact, can I impact God who's infinite and unchanging? When I began to realize certain basic things about God, that God transcends time, space, and matter. If God transcends time, space, and matter, that means that if over here would be the beginning of time, right over here, and time flows this way, right? So here's the beginning and here's my timeline. Where's God? God is up over here, transcending the timeline, having an identical perspective before time, during every moment of time, and after there no longer is time. Our minds can't understand what it means to transcend time. We're not even getting to transcending space and matter. Which means if we realize, really realize that God is transcendental, that means God has no needs. If God has no needs, why does God create? And what's the answer? So I've said this many times. If God is completely transcendental, then why, and God has no needs, then why does God create? So I've said this point many, many times. So I'm allowed to quote myself, right? And anybody who's from New York cannot possibly understand this. God is altruistic. Because if you grow up in New York, you don't believe that anybody's altruistic. And if somebody's nice to you, you get really scared. Right? Because you just figure that someone's got some kind of angle over here. But if I realize that God is completely transcendental and has no needs, that means God creates out of some phenomenal concept, which is called love, goodness, kindness. God creates out of an act of kindness. And if that's the case, I can't do anything for God, but I can try to do one thing, and that's try to be like God. I also, by the way, understand another phenomenal point, and that is that if I have an infinite God, right, and I have a finite universe, if I have an infinite God who transcends time, space, and matter, please stay with me on this point. This is very good. You can repeat this later on tonight. If you go out to a bar, you have a couple drinks, it won't make any sense. So try to get it down now. But it'll sound impressive. If you have one infinite God, transcends time, space, and matter, how exactly does creation take place? So creation, right? God is infinite, and creation is creating a finite universe. So what's the mathematical analysis? Infinite plus finite. So what's infinite plus finite? Infinite. First of all, do you realize how depressing that is? If infinite plus finite is infinite, that means that the whole thing, which is called us, existence, I just now brought into question. Now, I'm not saying you don't exist. I'm just saying that your existence is the product, is the result of a mathematical formula which you still don't understand, namely adding something finite to something infinite. The mystics, the Kabbalists, they had a very simple formula which they added to what I just now said. They said God doesn't create by adding something to the infinite. Rather, the infinite holds back, practices self-limitation. The word, the Kabbalistic terminology is tzimtzum. God practices self-limitation and allows coexistence, which means on a deep, on a profound Kabbalistic level, creation is not the result of God using his strength and going forward, but creation is the result of God holding back his strength and allowing coexistence. Therefore, for man, you're not with me? Therefore, for man, if we were to try to use our strength and trample upon others, we would, in effect, be doing the most ungodly thing. On the other hand, if we were to practice self-control, we become very, very similar to God. And by the way, what I just now revealed to you is the great Kabbalistic secret of how Shabbat works. Shabbos is all about self-control, because Shabbos is a commemoration to creation. God creates not by going forward and using strength. God creates by virtue of holding back infinity. So therefore, to be able to hold back infinity creates coexistence, creates peace, creates life. For man to hold back themselves and not to create, right? What the result of that would be is to be incredibly godly. And I know I skipped a couple steps over here. Perhaps the most important is that there's a fundamental difference between an infinite God and a finite God. An infinite God creates by holding back, but a finite individual creates by going forward. An infinite God, Right? That's the problem with infinity. Finite man can create by putting things together. And infinite God only creates by holding back. And perhaps this is what it means that we're in the image of God, which I would understand to be a mirror image almost. An infinite God and a finite man, and we're bound together because God created us. Now, let's get off of all this difficult philosophical, Kabbalistic terminology, and let's try to make sense of the book of Shmos. Where does the book begin? The book begins with the Jews in Egypt. God is going to come down and God is going to take them out. The taking out is actually, we're told right now, is going to be a partnership between God and man. By the way, Moses would have been much better off if God does the whole thing. But God says, no, you're going to do it. But why do we need God? Why do we need Moses to do it? And Moses said, I'm going to do this. And God said, I'll give you a sign. What's the sign? The sign was that when you take them out, you'll take them to Mount Sinai. You'll serve me on this God. You'll serve me on this mountain. Which mountain was that? I just gave you a hint. What was the mountain? Mount Sinai. Why is that a sign? First of all, I just now stretched the story of the Exodus from simply geographically leaving Egypt to geographically standing on Mount Sinai. But by the way, if you want to understand the sign, it would most likely be connected to the fact that at Mount Sinai, something profound takes place. What's that? The heavens open up and God speaks to man. And if you look at chapter 19 of Exodus, it tells us very clearly. God says to Moses, I will speak to you, and all the people will listen to my speaking to you. Which means the sign that God chose Moses will be displayed at Mount Sinai when God speaks to Moses and everybody sees. What does Moses say? Am I really the appropriate person to take him out? God says, I'll give you a sign. What's the sign? The sign is one that everybody will see. What will everybody see? Everybody will see that God is speaking to Moses. Which may get me to another point. Is Moses really chosen because he's the best magician? Is Moses really chosen because he is absolutely the best military leader? Which leads me to another point. When we speak or think about Moses in Jewish history, how do we refer to him? Do we refer to him as Moshe our king, Moshe Malkeinu? Do we speak of him as being Moshe the Redeemer, Moshe Moshienu? Or do we speak of him as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher? And again, Moshe wore a couple different hats. We could have called him different things. It is remarkable that we speak of him as being Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe the teacher. Because it could be that his particular skill set was not necessarily the best in order to perform the miracles which will be the plagues in Egypt. It could be that his skill set is not necessarily the best skill set in order to split the sea and anything else which takes place. But you know what his skill set is really good for? To be a teacher. Because what's necessary to be a really good teacher? You need humility. Moshe is a man who has incredible amount of humility. And what does Moshe say to God? I'm going to take the people out? Well, God just said, I'm with you. Right? I'm going to take the people out. God says, I'll be with you, but here's the sign. Leaving Egypt is never about geographically leaving Egypt. That's not the story. Remember, that's not in the book. What's it about? There's two other things that take place in the book. One is standing by Mount Sinai receiving the Torah. And what's the next point? Where does the book end? I know we just started it. Are you upset if I tell you the ending of the book? Will I ruin it for you? Don't tell you. How does the book end? The book ends with the completed Mishkan and the glory of God coming down and filling up the Mishkan. The book ends with a spiritual state where the glory of God is felt on earth. But by the way, this is incredibly significant. Because you can tell me the glory of God was felt when the plagues took place, but those happen very quickly and they disappear. Then you can tell me the glory of God was felt at Mount Sinai, when God speaks to the Jews at Mount Sinai, or speaks to Moshe and the Jews here at Mount Sinai. But that was a one-time, not even once in a millennium, that was a one-time event. But the glory of God that was felt one time at Mount Sinai will now be taken down and go on permanent display in the Mishkan. Which means real freedom is somehow connected to two more points. What's one point? One point is receiving the Torah. Which means now we learn there's a correlation between leaving Egypt and receiving the Torah, which should come as no surprise to us whatsoever, because within Jewish practice, what do we do as soon as we leave Egypt? We start counting the days till we stand by Mount Sinai, which links it together. The name of the next holiday is called Shavuos, weeks. We count 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, because Shavuos is about a linkage with leaving Egypt, which means leaving Egypt is where we celebrate freedom, is not the end of the freedom. That is the end of the slavery. The end of the slavery, the end of the domination, is the first part in order to get to freedom. Because if you're being dominated by somebody else, it's hard to have a lot of free emotional energy to be able to truly be free. But it seems to be now, based upon understanding this verse, that leaving Egypt was simply the prerequisite in order to be able to stand at Mount Sinai, in order to be able to achieve freedom. But I want you to think about it. You can tell me then that standing at Sinai was a whole new type of slavery. So instead of Pharaoh telling us what to do, now we're going to have God telling us what to do. Instead of Pharaoh working us only during our waking hours, we have God telling us what to do during the day, what to do during the night, who to sleep with, what to eat, and what to do every time in between. So did we really do a good deal over here? So apparently, accepting the Torah is what gives us freedom. And again, if freedom is the freedom from the things which control us, the laws of the Torah and the ideas of the Torah is exactly the tools which are necessary in order to set us free. Because man, see, we go through a lot of stages in life. When you're young, you think you're invincible. When you're young, you don't know anything about death. When you're a little bit older, you know that there's a thing called death, but you think you're invincible. When you get a little bit older, you give up because you say you're going to die anyway, so you may as well enjoy yourself as much as possible. Man walks around with an incredible amount of neuroses. That's the human condition. There's all kinds of things which scare us. At every stage in our life, there are things that scare us terribly. The Torah is supposed to give us something which not only will free us, but will free us psychologically as well. Free us in terms of getting clarity on what are the significant things in life. But I want you to appreciate something. In order for God to speak to us at Sinai, something else has to take place that I already indicated before. It means that Sinai is going to be a rendezvous between an infinite God and a finite person, a finite mind. That itself is an indication. Again, you think that God speaking at Sinai is the most wondrous sound and light show ever, but if at that moment you think, okay, now I got it, now I understand God because I saw God at Sinai, what you saw was one glimpse of what there really is, which means in order, and this is something, again, you have to think through, in order for there to be a revelation, every revelation of God necessitates an incredible amount of concealment. Because you can't possibly reveal something which transcends time, space, and matter. It's the human condition that doesn't allow that. So even when we have our revelations, we need to deeply understand that the revelation is because of concealment, which goes back to the same point, that just like creation is a moment where God holds back infinity and allows coexistence, Sinai is the second point in history where God holds back infinity and allows there to be a revelation, but that comes back to the same point, which leads us to the third part of the book. The third part of the book is the glory of God coming and filling up a particular area, which means at that particular point, the glory of God could be felt. But don't fool yourself into thinking, now I understand what transcendence is. But it reveals something else, which I think is really the issue. The idea of the Mishkan, which is the conclusion of the book, which ultimately gives freedom, is the realization that the divine can be felt on earth. Should I say that again? You're already caught up in this. It's the realization that the divine can be felt on earth. That ultimately is what frees us. That ultimately what gives us freedom. Because the divine can be felt on earth when I am caught on these struggles, when I'm caught someplace in between what my good inclination, my evil inclination is telling me, and I don't know which is which makes it even more complicated. How can I possibly prove the divine? How can I possibly cling to the divine if I don't know what the divine is? Or how can I cling to the divine if I don't think the divine is ever here? Which means the very concept of God building a temple, or God telling us to build a temple. And what does God say when he tells us to build a temple? If you build it, I will come. That's what he says. Right? Vasuli mikdash v'shachanti besocham. You build for me a holy place, and I will come and have my glory fill up that particular place. Or even better, vasuli mikdash, build for me mikdash v'shachanti bitocham, and I will now fill you up. Which means, as the famous Kutzker Rebbe once said, somebody asked him a question, where is God? And what answer did he give? Wherever you allow him to be. And that's the answer. Where is God? Wherever you allow him to be. But at that moment, when the Mishkan is completed and the glory of God comes down, now the people understand something. That this human condition, this physical universe, this universe which is limited by time, space, and matter, nonetheless has the ability of having a relationship with the divine. And once there's a possibility of relationship with the divine, all kinds of other things are possible as well, including and perhaps most importantly, that we are capable of freedom. Because we are capable of choices. We're capable of seeking the divine instead of feeling that we are exclusively physical beings who are only stuck within our own physical limitations. That's the steps of the book which take us from Egypt, where we are being crushed, to physically, geographically leaving Egypt, to standing at Mount Sinai and having a rendezvous with God, to take us to the last part of the book, which is an attempt to bring the divine down to earth on a permanent basis. That's what Judaism is. Judaism is the attempt to bring the divine down, which means, as the Kutzker Rebbe said, where is God? And the answer is wherever we allow him, that now becomes our goal. Our goal is to allow God to be in more and more places. And as we allow God to enter into more and more places, we will then become more and more empowered to win that struggle between the physical and between the divine. Have a good Shabbos, gentlemen.